Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The world works in certain ways until a new great idea comes along and changes everything.
We need a name.
We live.
We dream.
We work.
I'm Travis Kalanick, and I will never back down from a fight. And if no one wants to believe in me, I'll make them believe by being undeniable.
These kids don't overthink. They don't get bogged down about the way things have always been done. They want to change things now.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching Downfall of the Startups. I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson. I'm here today with Vanity Fair Hollywood editor Hillary Busis. Hillary, hello.
Hi, Richard. I'm very excited to elevate the world's consciousness together.
I know. I mean, I feel like we've been doing that individually for years, and now it's great to do it together finally. So today we'll be covering three episodes. Super Pumped episode 4 called Boober, The Dropout episode 6, Iron Sisters, and We Crashed episode 4, which is called 4.4. Later on in the episode, we'll hear our colleague Katie Rich's interview with Vanity Fair writer Gabriel Sherman, who in 2019 wrote a feature for the magazine about Adam Newman and his spectacular fall from grace. He has lots of interesting stuff to say about Newman and Newman's connections to Uber's Travis Kalanick. As ever, if you have any questions, comments, corrections, whatever, as you listen along, please email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. All right, so to start off, Hillary, I have to ask you a very important, perhaps difficult question. Which is a more striking image? Rebecca Newman in full Navi regalia or Elizabeth Holmes doing a wild dance while wearing a mask of her own face?
Honestly, I feel like neither of those images maybe is as haunting as the Dropout's recreation of Elizabeth Holmes's Errol Morris commercials, where that just iconic image of her head floating on the white background, her enormous eyes reflecting the camera. I mean, it's that's something that is tough to get out of your head once you've seen it.
There's that moment in this episode where you hear that, you know, the fictional Errol Morris off screen, and he's like, no, actually, we want you to look into this and that in the camera. And then her eyes turn directly at you. And it's like, ugh. it's quite something. Have you seen his documentary about this whole thing?
I have. Yeah. Back when it came out.
Because he somehow like retained rights or something to this exact footage, and it's stitched throughout. I don't think the doc is that great, but like that part of it is really fascinating.
It is, yeah. It's pretty. I mean, what's amazing too is that when he filmed that commercial, or those commercials, I'm not really sure if something actually happened to the footage before he used it in the documentary. But when he was filming it, he was like so many other people under the spell of Elizabeth Holmes, and you know, clearly believed her to be a visionary, believed her to be this, I mean, what she said she was, which is, I mean, that's the interesting tension in that documentary, which The Dropout doesn't really get into because it has so much else to talk about. But
yeah, he's basically, that film kind of feels like him trying to get to the root of why he believed it, you mm-hmm. know, when there was so much mounting evidence. And we see that evidence begin to really coalesce in this episode. We have John Carreyrou brought in, the Wall Street Journal reporter who kind of blew this thing wide open. And we have the introduction of a really key figure, someone that Liz Merriweather, the showrunner, mentioned when I interviewed her a couple episodes ago, is Erica Chung, who was, along with Tyler Schultz, one of the really early whistleblowers. How do you feel like the show handled all that? Because there were a lot of moving parts between what Tyler and Erica are doing and then what Phyllis and Richard's Fuse are doing. Did it all sort of map out kind of coherently for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the impressive thing about The Dropout. That it manages to weave all together all of these threads simultaneously without being confusing, without doing too much timeline jumping, without a lot of unnecessary back and forth. And B, that it manages to make this story, which I feel like I at least know pretty well, having, you know, read Bad Blood and listened to the podcast that the show is based on, and also having seen the Errol Morris documentary, like having consumed all of that, I still find the show really fascinating, really well done, and like it does have new insights to add to that pile of stories about Elizabeth Holmes, who is maybe at this point, I don't know, one of the most written about criminals of the 21st century. But yeah, I love the way that this episode ping-pongs back between Tyler and Erica doing their kind of Scooby-Doo mystery solving, and like the Boomer Brigade coming together, like these disgruntled older Avengers all uniting to try to take Elizabeth down, and the introduction of Carew and everything, and the introduction of a surprise whistleblower at the end of the episode too. I mean, I think that it's a smart way to illustrate the forces that were kind of joining in order, and how many people it took, I guess, to uncover the deception at the heart of Theranos, which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, here you have in this episode five people who really know what they're talking about saying this is all bullshit, and it still took a while after this for this to all kind of come out. But yeah, I think what you said about, like, you know, you've read Bad Blood, I listened to John Carreyrou's podcast about her trial. Like, I feel like we're both pretty well versed in at least the basic plot beats of that real life story. But I think what the show is able to do so well, and this episode is a sterling example of that, is, yes, it's imagining. We don't know these things for facts, but kind of put us in the human sort of side of things and see the roundness of even Elizabeth Holmes as a person. I had sort of made the supposition last week that with the death of Ian Gibbons, that was really when Elizabeth on this show really becomes the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she is really functioning as the villain in this episode. But we do see, especially in her kind of creepy interactions with Sonny, increasingly creepy interactions with Sonny, that while she was hard charging and really, you know, at this point now harming actual people, potentially, there's still, I don't know. Do you still find something dimly sympathetic about her at this point in the show?
I mean, certainly she's very in over her head. She understands that she has decided that the way to get through it is by doubling down, which obviously is a terrible, terrible mistake to make. I don't know. She certainly gets less sympathetic, you know, after Tyler confronts her at the birthday party, tells her what he knows, and is hoping that somehow she was unaware of this, that this is kind of happening underneath her. And then I feel like that's a sort of a real, like, villain heel turn too, when she tells him, like, unblinkingly, very confidently, you don't know what you're talking about, just, you know, openly lying to him. And she doesn't seem to be feeling much remorse, at least as characterized by the show, for what she's doing. I mean, you're sympathetic, I think, certainly about her relationship with Sonny, who's clearly controlling and volatile. And I mean, that is obviously a very toxic relationship. I think that you can feel sympathy for her in that, but not really understand why she is, you know, committing the fraud that she's committing at the same time.
Yeah. And also, you know, kind of further testing that sympathy in this episode. And also there's a parallel here between the episode of Super Pumped with the Austin Guyte character and Susan Fowler, who would go on to become kind of the really first whistleblower about the culture at Uber.
Mm-hmm.
Where there are these women, I mean, in Elizabeth's case, she's being interviewed and she's talking about, the Iron Sisters, you know, that there's an Iron Lady next to a glass ceiling, or whatever, however she puts it.
Next to every glass ceiling, there's an Iron
thank
Lady.
You. Could you do the rest of the episode in that voice, please?
Richard, it would be my dream.
But then you have Phyllis Gardner and now Erica Chung coming from very different directions to be like, well, no, I'm a woman in tech too. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that, like, we should just believe this, like, obvious charlatan. So I think this episode of The Dropout, and to a slightly lesser extent, although, you know, there's Ariana Huffington also in this episode of Super Pumped, like, women being brought into these spaces and functioning them in them in different ways and really challenging the narrative that, like, at least Holmes was trying to establish, which is, like, if you don't support me, well, you're probably a little bit sexist. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, it's an interesting complicating of, I hate this term now and feel like it's gotten so overused, but it is apt here, the girl boss, the archetype of, you know, the aughts and the 20-teens of this female CEO who is somehow a barrier-breaking, groundbreaking feminist just by virtue of the fact that she's a woman and she has a business, which is something that obviously got very complicated in the past couple of years, especially as several of those women were found to have problematic business practices and, you know, problematic labor relations and, you know, were firing employees for being pregnant and things like that. But yeah, I mean, The Dropout especially, I think, and I'm sure that it's coming on Super Pumped too, as Susan Fowler kind of gets to be more of a central character, if she gets to be more of a central character. But I think that was really interesting on The Dropout this episode too, how it complicates this narrative that Elizabeth has been promoting and benefiting from, that, you know, somehow she deserves more benefit of the doubt and she deserves support simply because she's a woman in a male-dominated field. And I think that that's really interesting, especially, you know, when it comes to, I think, Laurie Metcalf's character is trying to figure out why everybody wants to believe in her so much. It's really, the answer is because she's a woman and because there are not very many women in tech. And A, it makes people feel good about themselves for supporting a woman in tech. And B, there is something about her. She is pretty and blonde, like William H. Macy's character says, and that makes the men in tech feel flattered that she would be paying attention to them, that she'd be trying to woo them to be on her board and everything. And yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated, interesting set of conflicting variables.
Yeah, I think in this episode, you really see that kind of the men feeling a little flattered, especially in George Shultz, mm-hmm. you know, who, when Tyler confronts him with really credible, you know, testimony, essentially about, like, what's going on behind the scenes.
And it's his own grandson.
Yeah, exactly. And this, you know, in real life, this tore this relationship apart, and they did not reconcile before George Shultz died, which is pretty sad. But he talks about, you know, Elizabeth and the company in these kind of very vague terms because he doesn't really know what they're doing. But there's something about Elizabeth, you know, they're cozy planning the birthday party. And even his wife, played by Ann Archer, seems to be a little bit like, what is going on here? And I don't think that it's supposed to be that George Shultz, like, has a crush on her or is sort of, you know,
or even that he's senile or something. It's just, you know, he is a man who is used to being right. And the implication that somehow he could have bet on the wrong horse is enough to, like, send him in the other direction and set him against his own kin.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, in terms of that there are so few women in tech, like, that's what makes the Erica, I mean, character in this, you know, show's version of things so heartbreaking. And it happens quickly. I kind of thought they would maybe stretch her disillusionment over a couple episodes, but we're nearing the end of the series, and so maybe they just had to kind of compact it. But, like, the almost instant disappointment and sort of just like, wait, what is going on here? Like, I would have to imagine that that heartbreak is compounded by the fact that this was a rare, you know, female CEO in this incredibly male space, who actually is just built a house of cards.
Oh yeah, totally. It must be a lot more disappointing to be kind of betrayed or baited and switched by somebody who you were primed to trust because you identified with them.
And we have an interesting, I don't know, inversion of that in this episode of Super Pumped, where, you know, we meet Uma Thurman as Ariana Huffington, and she has this little tete-a-tete with Travis, and she's like, oh, I know you're an asshole, but you know what? You gotta be. You have to kind of stand firm in this. And so she's, and then, of course, she ends up with a board seat that she, believes stepped down from in 2019, so 2 years after Kalanick had left. She was there for a bit longer. And you know, her approach along with Austin Geitz, when Susan Fowler approaches her, is basically like, yeah, but this is kind of the world, you know, and you just kind of deal with it, which, like, that doesn't seem obviously like a good approach either. But it is interesting to see these two kind of journeys into these spaces told different ways on these shows.
Yeah, I mean, a very chilling and, you know, very, like, believable quote from the HR rep to Susan is, I don't see a need to ruin his life over something so small. It really feels like it kind of crystallizes a pre-Me Too especially mindset.
As if, like, getting in trouble at Uber is life-ruining, you know? what do you make of Uma Thurman as Arianna Huffington?
I mean, I honestly, I think that what Super Pump has been missing is a famous actress doing a silly voice.
Yep.
So the introduction of Arianna is coming not a moment too soon. It's sort of tough to say. She doesn't have a ton of screen time in this episode. Her introduction happens. You have the Tarantino narration calling her, you know, like, this visionary. I mean, I wrote this down too because it just felt really, really emblematic of the Tarantino narration. This is not somebody who says the first thing that pops into her cabeza, daddy-o.
Like, yeah. And the weird irony of having Tarantino narrate it while it's Uma Thurman. There's something very strange about that.
Him talking about how beautiful and, like, and brilliant she is. That is a layer that I hadn't considered.
At least he didn't say the best feet in tech or something, you know, because that would have been really bad. But I think it's a really interesting kind of meta comment on the show that her arrival as this, you know, it is a famous actor playing Arianna. Arianna Huffington herself is quite famous. So that's part of the sort of jolt of seeing her show up in this episode. But it's also like there are so few women on the show.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden now we have Austin moving more to the center of the story. And she is someone who is still kind of, she doesn't work for Uber anymore, but she still sort of has kind words to say about Uber and Kalanick to some extent. And then we have Susan Fowler. So all of a sudden these women are kind of entering this space and it's not their fault at all, but it's disruptive to the ecosystem, the order of things. And I guess I would have to kind of credit the showrunners for kind of waiting to introduce this because it needs to land, I think, as a jolt to the system, you know, like because we've been spending so much time with men.
Yeah, I'll be really interested to see what it does with Arianna, if she becomes more of a rounded character or is sort of this like benevolent like force kind of floating over Uber. I don't know how much interiority we should expect.
Yeah, I didn't really know anything about, I kind of had forgotten that she was even on the board of Uber. I didn't, you know, I guess I hadn't been paying attention to her whereabouts around this time. So yeah, I don't really know what to expect, but even if it's just, you know, a sort of pop in here and there at a board meeting scene, I'm liking what Thurman's doing.
I think she sounds like Arianna Huffington.
Yeah, totally. And I think you're right that we need, you know, we've become pretty inured to funny voices on these shows, which means we should probably also bring in We Crashed 4.4, because while a good, you know, portion of the episode is focused on Adam pursuing SoftBank, Masayoshi Son, who is the head of SoftBank and gave them the titular $4.4 billion investment. And I believe still has not gotten any of the many billions of dollars it invested back from WeWork. So that's, you know, a huge focus of the episode. But we also have this really interesting narrative with Rebecca, who, you know, does the Na'vi costume for, that's for a school kind of fundraiser thing?
Yes, it's some kind of costume party. I'm sure that school desperately needs money.
I mean, have you ever shown up like overdressed or overcostumed for something? Do you know that particular like plop of dread and horror when you walk into a room and no one else is as dressed up as you are?
I mean, I guess at least they didn't have her as a Playboy bunny, which is traditional in setups like that.
Yes, correct. I'm reminded of a time when I was 7 or 8 and I was invited to a Halloween party. Just a few of the boys that I was friends with at school. And it was kind of a big deal because I think I'd never like been to like a little party before like that, or at least that I was invited to, and it wasn't like someone's mom asking my mom if I could come. And so it was a Halloween party, and I mean, I was about 8 years out, away from being from coming out, but I dressed up in full witch regalia, like full wig, hat, dress, like pointy shoes. I mean, I went full tilt, and I show up, and the other boys are like have like a little robber mask on,
oh, or God.
Like, or, and I mean, it was the most mortifying. I think about that is that Katie Dippel tweet?
Oh, where, about the Babadook. You were just yeah, you took the words yeah, out of my mouth, yeah.
Yeah. So as much as I find Rebecca to be, especially they really amp up the woo-woo talk in this episode, she's a grating figure and I think, you know, was complicit in a lot of WeWork sins. But like, I did feel for her in that moment. And so did Alicia Kennedy, the character played by America Ferrara, who is an interesting new infusion of energy. What did you make of Alicia's introduction? And do you have any theories about how she's going to kind of function throughout the series going forward?
Well, she's definitely going to be a wedge between Rebecca and Adam as both of them have designs on her. I mean, it's interesting to see Rebecca kind of form a friendship that's separate from and apart, like separate and apart from WeWork and Adam. And that is something like that she wants to be hers. And then he kind of immediately swoops in and, you know, steals Alicia and gives her a job, which is I think that's pretty poignant and does kind of make you feel for her. Like it is difficult to have empathy for her considering kind of everything about her life and about her choices, but she does seem very fundamentally lonely, and you can see how excited she is to finally meet somebody that she feels like can be a relationship that's primarily revolved around her and another person that she just kind of wants to. She's been searching sort of for her purpose and something that can like give her life meaning outside of her relationships with men especially, and then to see that kind of pulled away from her, you know, it's sad, and it does make you feel for her.
Yeah, especially because she had that sad little scene where she Googled herself and it was like, who is Gwyneth Paltrow's cousin?
Exactly.
And then it was like Rebecca Newman, Adam Newman. And then she Googles Alicia, who I believe is a fictional person.
She is, although if you read Gabe Sherman's 2019 WeWork story, there's a hint as to who she may be based on. And I'm not sure if saying that would be a spoiler. But in that story, it seems like there's a real life analog for the character.
Well, spoiler or not, that's a great, you've provided a great segue to the interview that Katie Rich did with Gabe Sherman, which we'll go to now.
All right, great.
Okay, so I'm here with Gabe Sherman, special correspondent for Vanity Fair. First of all, hi, Gabe. Thank you for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
So I, devoured your story from the fall of 2019 about WeWork, as did so many other people. And before I pepper you with questions about Adam Newman and how this company kind of rose and fall, your work for Vanity Fair is a lot about the Trump administration, especially back then, about Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell. How did WeWork wind up being the topic for you at that point?
Well, at the time, in the fall of 2019, the collapse of WeWork's IPO was one of the biggest stories in the business world. I mean, it's hard to remember, you know, before COVID and before the tragedy in Ukraine. I mean, there were so many other stories that were dominating the headlines. And we at Vanity Fair and The Hive especially were fascinated with the collapse of Adam Newman's empire. So, you know, we decided that this timing and the scale of the story was right for a magazine feature.
Had you been following WeWork and its rise before that point, or was this really the first time you dove into it?
I had been following it, obviously, as you know, as someone who's fascinated by the world of power and business. And in fact, you know, having covered the Trump administration, I knew, you know, some of the players in the WeWork world. You know, Adam Newman had grown close with Jared Kushner, of course, and so I knew about that relationship. And, you know, actually, this is sort of dating myself now, but my first job in journalism in the early 2000s was as a real estate reporter for the New York Observer before Jared Kushner had bought the paper. And so, you know, I had sort of had this fondness for the real estate beat, you know, throughout my career, even though I had moved on from it. So this was actually a chance to circle back with a lot of the sources that I had, you know, made, you know, more than 10 years ago. So it felt like a natural assignment for me.
Well, and I think We Crash, especially in its earlier episodes, is really frank about how New York real estate is this really clubby, really well-established world that is hard to break into. And Adam Newman, and later on in this fourth episode that we're covering on this week's episode, kind of using other people in other cities to break into real estate markets. What was his power for convincing these very entrenched, very rich real estate owners to go with him?
You know, I think really what Adam was so brilliant as was seeing himself as a gatekeeper to a rising generation. You know, real estate in New York especially is dominated by, you know, old white men who, you know, wanted to feel like they were in touch with the culture. And, you know, Adam could sort of parlay that insecurity and that fear amongst these older billionaires that they were missing out on the next big thing to seduce them and get them to invest millions of dollars in WeWork. So that was part of the appeal, was that it wasn't necessarily he was selling real estate. He was selling kind of this dream that he understood how millennials were going to work, and that these co-working spaces that felt more like clubhouses and frat houses would be the future of offices. And if you're, you know, a billionaire who owns, you know, buildings all across Manhattan, and you're thinking, I need to fill these buildings with tenants, you know, Adam made a compelling case that the people that he could relate to were going to be the ones filling those offices.
Your story uses this great term, geezer capitalists, for the people who are investing in WeWork. And I don't know if you've watched the Hulu series, The Dropout, which is about Elizabeth Holmes, but there's an episode that's about the Walgreens executives. I think a similar impulse, right, of these people who worry that they're getting left behind. Is that what's driving all of these crazy Silicon Valley stories, these old white men who think that they are going to miss out unless they go with these convincing schemers?
I mean, I think, you know, certainly in the case of Theranos and WeWork, these were both companies that were, you know, highly valued, but, you know, definitely not profitable. I think, you know, in this case, this was clearly a pattern where the charismatic founders were manipulating the insecurities of these older businessmen who felt like they were going to get left behind. You know, obviously, you know, companies like Google and Facebook and Instagram, you know, real tech companies that have, you know, tremendous underlying businesses to them, they don't need that kind of salesmanship that Elizabeth Holmes and Adam Newman had. I think that's really what the difference is. Fundamentally, Theranos and WeWork just were not real companies.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we've been kind of broadly calling this about tech scams, where it's like Uber, the Uber show, the Theranos show, and WeWork. But WeWork was doing what it was selling, right? Like, it's more of a real company than Theranos, right?
Sure. No, of course. I think, yes, it was in that sense, it was a legitimate company. I think the economics that Adam Newman was promising and the valuation that he expected were completely out of touch with what ultimately is just a pretty standard business. I mean, what WeWork does is they sell leases to people and basically subleases. WeWork leases the space, and then they go out and find people to pay them a monthly membership, and they, you know, hopefully profit off the difference. But I mean, that has been, you know, co-working was in existence long before Adam Newman came around. I mean, it was not a glamorous industry. It was a, you know, temporary office space is a pretty kind of like low profile business. But what he did was that he tricked the marketplace to think that what he was selling was kind of a lifestyle and a movement that should be valued like a tech company. And that's where I feel like what he was selling was not representing what the actual business was. And if you see today, you know, WeWork today is, you know, continues on in a much, you know, smaller way. And it's not, you know, it's doing what it's doing, but you don't read about it in the headlines because, again, it's not overpromising what it's actually trying to do.
Yeah. Well, in this fourth episode, there's a point where Adam Newman, played by Jared Leto, is saying, well, we have to spend money to have this rapid growth. And his colleagues are like, why does it have to be rapid? But I feel like that's a story that comes up over and over again in tech, where they're just so obsessed with growth at that level. Does it have to be that way? Like, or is there, can anyone learn from this and not do that?
I think what you've sort of zeroed in on, it's interesting that you mentioned Uber, is my associate's son, Masa, who controlled SoftBank, which was really the main investor in WeWork. That was his philosophy. And he actually was also one of the main investors in Uber. And what his philosophy was that he would sort of blitzkrieg these businesses, throw money at them so that they would grow so big that they would essentially corner the market and force out any other competitors.
Mm.
And, you know, maybe on paper that theory might work, but in reality, what it was doing was that they were just throwing money at businesses that didn't have the underlying profitability, so that once the music stopped, they were just a house of cards and it collapsed.
Yeah. Yeah. The speaking of Uber too, in your piece from 2019, you said that I think Adam Neumann reached out to Travis Kalanick when he was worried that Benchmark Capital on the Super Pump, Bill Gurley plays a major role in that. What do you know about Adam Neumann and Travis Kalanick, like being in touch with that degree, or even like feeling like similar figures? Do they feel like similar figures to you?
Yes and no. I mean, I think they were both obviously charismatic and built sort of a cult of personality around themselves. I mean, I think, you know, obviously Adam was, you know, married with five kids, and, you know, some of his, you know, it was less sort of the bro-y kind of culture that Travis cultivated at Uber. But I think, you know, fundamentally they were both, once their investors realized that the jig was up, they both, you know, suffered the same fate. I think also what Adam's relationship with Travis kind of points to is also the fact that Adam cultivated kind of his Rolodex was like billionaires, heads of state, other CEOs. He fashioned himself as like somebody who, you know, only socialized and communicated with the most powerful people in the world. And I think a lot of people around Adam were just kind of like completely shocked that he had that self-confidence to think that he was on, you know, the level of all of these other people.
Yeah, there's a moment in this fourth episode where America Ferrera, playing this character, I want to ask you about later, but she asks in Hathaway's Rebecca Newman, like, is Adam for real? And I think that's a question that you ask yourself watching this whole show. Like, how much does he believe in what he's saying? How much do you think he was for real?
I guess where I come down is, does it really matter? Because, mm-hmm. you know, obviously he was real enough to have convinced his investors and his employees to buy into his vision. So, you know, I find sometimes with these people, they tell themselves the story over and over again so that they ultimately start to believe their own bullshit. But again, it's like, what does he truly believe? That's kind of the territory for novelists. It's like, as a reporter and a writer, I can only, you know, write about what I saw. And he was real enough that $12 billion was invested into his company.
Yeah, I mean, and the same question goes for Rebecca Newman, too. And what the We Crashed kind of angle is showing the partnership between the two of them and how they kind of pump each other up. But from your reporting, it does seem like Rebecca was also at least presented herself to be a true believer in the same way as him.
Yeah, I mean, she sort of cultivated this Lady Macbeth role for herself, kind of the power behind the scenes. And she was, you know, inside the office, it's interesting that a lot of the employees and senior executives were more scared of her than of Adam, because if you got on the wrong side of Rebecca, like, she would very quickly either get you fired or sidelined. And there was this, you know, it played out in both like ways that are hilarious and tragic. You know, there was this one anecdote in my article about how she had met the mechanic for their private jet, and she just didn't kind of like this guy, and so they had to fire this. You know, blue collar guy who's, you know, was hired to work on their plane, and she just cast him aside because she didn't like him. And I think, you know, the sort of entitlement that demonstrates, I think, is the dark side of what Adam and Newman, Adam and Rebecca came to represent.
Yeah. And then, as I mentioned, the America Ferrera character who comes in this episode, who is fictional, but seems to me to be representing the SoulCycle founder, Julie Rice, who shows up mm-hmm. in your article. And can you just recount that story of what happened in real life?
Well, yeah, I mean, Julie was really one of the real grown-ups that WeWork was able to recruit. You know, I think we should just back up and say that most of the people that worked at WeWork, they were, you know, straight out of college. This was sort of their first job, and they kind of bought into Adam's vision. You know, as WeWork grew, they needed to start to recruit some more seasoned business people. And so it was a big deal when WeWork recruited Julie Rice to join the company as chief brand officer, because SoulCycle at the time had kind of built this national following. And so she came on, and shortly after joining the company, Rebecca came back from maternity leave and basically said, well, I'm going to have your job now. That's my title. And, you know, it's a big deal having recruited someone to take the leap to join the company, just to be told like, oh, wait, the founder's wife is going to take your job. And so I think that was kind of a warning sign that, you know, WeWork, as long as Adam and Rebecca were controlling the company, was never going to recruit the kind of talent it needed to outgrow the kind of startup phase.
Yeah, because it was so cult of personality driven, right? Like, they just didn't have the ability to run an office the way that normal people would want to work in an office.
Well, and I think, you know, Adam would brag to people that he controlled the board. And even when he was flaming out and all after the scandals were starting to appear in the newspapers, you know, he said that, you know, I could fire the board if I wanted to. And he never thought that his day would come. And I think, you know, again, that's why at the end of the day, I, as a reporter, having covered the story, I sort of put a lot of the blame on the investors. I mean, these are the supposed savvy, sophisticated people that, you know, control billions of dollars of their clients' money, and that they could just be so kind of duped by this guy. I mean, we focus a lot on Adam and his eccentricities, and but I think ultimately, you know, Masa and the other venture capitalists who put all the money into them, I mean, they're the ones that really look dumb.
Yeah, and Masa is kind of is introduced in this episode, and you see how what a huge power he was. You know, at the end of the episode, he invests $4.4 billion, I think it is, in WeWork. And later on, you see him meeting with Adam and saying, like, you know, people say you're acting crazy, but I don't think you're acting crazy enough. He's a smart businessman. Why would anyone ever tell Adam Newman he's acting crazy enough? What is this guy's philosophy behind that?
Well, I think I would sort of push back or challenge a little bit the idea of Masa being a smart businessman. I mean, he was incredibly successful, and SoftBank was a telecom company that made a lot of money doing one thing, but then he turned all that money into a venture capital fund and has been throwing money at businesses, you know, left and right that have been crashing and burning, you know, whether it's, you know, WeWork or Uber, which again has never turned a profit. So I think Masa also is another kind of person that, you know, started to believe his own bullshit. And, you know, the track record, you know, does not, you know, speak highly of him as an investor. I think he's obviously a very smart businessman who did well at one thing, but it doesn't mean, like, you can't just create a company out of nothing. I mean, you have to really have the fundamentals. I don't think Masa was really interested in this, doing the sort of the serious work of building a company step by step. He just wanted to snap his fingers, and he wanted Adam to just, you know, create this empire out of whole cloth. And that, again, once the music stopped, the whole thing crashed down.
Yeah. Are we past this point of the way investments work for those of us who don't follow Silicon Valley regularly? Does it work this way still, or have people learned from Uber and WeWork and other examples?
You know, I think the IPO market has definitely cooled. I think, you know, we are in a little bit of a different place, you know, post-COVID. You know, in the run-up to WeWork's crash, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States and other institutions had pumped so much cash into the economy that investors like Masa just were sitting on piles of money that they needed to find something to do with it. And so the only thing they could do was try to find these investments that, you know, were risky but had the promise of a high return. I think now that, not to get too wonkish here, but like, the Fed is slowly raising interest rates. You know, it seems like there is some dose of reality coming back to investing, where you know, the valuations. If you look at, say, Peloton, right?
Yeah.
You know, Peloton saw its valuation explode, and now it's, you know, back to reality. And so, you know, I think there is, whether it's Zoom or Peloton, I think there is still some euphoria around some of these startups, but very quickly investors are losing their patience. Once it's clear that they're not living up to the hype.
Yeah. So you've had your work turn into fiction before, and we're in this boom moment right now of you know, the Uber, the Theranos, the WeWork shows all airing at the same time. Like, what do you make of it as a journalist when these shows get fictionalized and kind of get put in the public imagination? Do you wish that they stuck more to the facts, or do you get the enduring fascination here?
Well, I mean, listen, they're not documentaries. So, as you know, as long as the projects are presenting themselves as drama and as fiction, I mean, I think it's, you know, people have been making art out of life for, you know, since the beginning of time. So that's nothing new. I mean, I think it's, I mean, listen, as a journalist, having seen the impact my articles about Roger Ailes had versus like turning it into a Showtime series, I mean, there is something irresistible about seeing like a great actor inhabit the role of this charismatic, flawed figure. And so, you know, I found with my work, it definitely connected with people in a different way than it did through journalism. And, you know, I think you can, my sort of philosophy was that you could, you know, play with time and you could make some dramatic choices, but they all had to be grounded in the facts of the story. I think once you start to really, like for example, The Social Network, which was a great movie. I loved it as a movie, but anyone who knows Mark Zuckerberg from his Harvard days knows that he wasn't like pining after this girlfriend, and the origin of Facebook wasn't because he was trying to win back, you know, the girl that broke up with him.
Yeah.
So that's a case where I loved it as a movie, but as turning life into a story, I felt like that's a license that was a bridge too far for if I was adapting my work.
I just feel so gratified as, you know, again, someone who's not following these IPOs regularly, but learning from watching these shows altogether about the geezer capitalists and things like that, that do feel so true to how this works. It feels like these shows are all getting at something really fundamentally true about this world, even if all the details aren't all there.
Yeah. I mean, especially because, like, you know, what's the joke? Like, okay, boomer, like these investors who have all the money and they're in their 60s, 70s, and sometimes even 80s, like, instead of just like going out into the sunset and letting millennials like have their due, like they still want to be in the game. Like they still want to feel like they matter. And so I think, you know, it was the chutzpah of people like Adam Newman and Elizabeth Holmes who saw that these old guys just, you know, if you could make them feel relevant again, they would just turn over their checkbook to you.
Yeah. God, what happens when the boomers are gone? Where's all the where's all the money going to go? Oh, maybe last question. Does Jared Leto feel right as Adam Newman to you? Is that the Adam Newman that you know or have reported on?
I mean, you know, it all has to be like believable in the context of the series. I mean, I think the long hair and the Israeli accent, it's you know, I think it's again, I feel like, yeah, he's the kind of actor that can disappear into a character, as I obviously saw as well in House of Gucci. So
yeah,
this is the start of his, he's done Italian and Israeli, and we'll see, maybe he'll do,
he'll play
Putin next.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz. Who should be the mayor of New York?
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki?
Yes?
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Hillary, another thing that I wanted to discuss about this episode of We Crashed is the connection between this show and Super Pumped, between WeWork and Uber, which is this benchmark capital. In We Crashed, we meet a character named Cameron Lautner, who, again, I'm not sure that's a real person. And obviously, we have Bill Gurley over at Uber, who is the head of Benchmark. How do you find, now that we're halfway through a lot of these seasons of these shows, like, is the business stuff still as interesting to you as the person stuff? Because I think We Crashed in particular is much more of like a human drama with some business thrown in, and sometimes I find that I'm a little bit zoning out when we get into the real weeds of the money.
Yeah, I'm with you. If for no other reason than just the amounts of money being thrown around are so ridiculous and exorbitant as to sound fake. Like, I can't imagine $4.4 billion. Like, it seems impossible that that amount of money exists in one place and can't be given and taken to another place, and there would still be money left in the first. Like, that is just very difficult for my tiny mind to comprehend.
I mean, it's more than I make in a year, you know? No, but isn't there some sort of scientific precept that, like, human beings can't actually imagine a number bigger than 1,000? Like, if you're like 10,000 people, your brain shuts off trying to count to 1,000, you know, like, And I agree that the numbers are so large that it almost starts to seem meaningless, which of course it's not, you know, but it's treated as such. I mean, you watch in this episode of We Crashed as, you know,
they're losing $2.3 million a day. That's ludicrous.
Yeah. Like, again, more than I make in a week. And yet, like, this $4.4 billion is handed over because of, I mean, maybe it was more complicated in real life, but like, because of a speech at a tech conference that he related to, you know,
because Masa likes that he doesn't wear shoes.
Yeah. He says you're crazy, but oh, by the way, crazy. Here's $4.4 billion.
Buy a pair of shoes with it.
Yeah, exactly. And then you also have, you know, on The Dropout, like Sonny, who said he made an offer on a big mansion that he and Elizabeth can live together. And I think that in The Dropout in particular, the money doesn't. I mean, obviously, that's why Walgreens is there. That's why certain board members are involved, like, and certain employees. They want to get that cash out when the company goes public. But Elizabeth herself doesn't really seem to be. She says she wants to be a billionaire in the first episode, but the money doesn't seem to be the top concern. It's more the sort of intangible, I'm going to change the world kind of thing. And so I don't know. I thought it was an interesting little scene to be like, oh right, but these people are, you know, at least in theory, she and Sonny very rich at this moment.
Yeah, and I mean, the shared universe of it all is also interesting. You know, that benchmark is popping up more than once. I think it's funny that Anthony Edwards also played a money man in Inventing Anna on Netflix, which is taking place at the same time as these shows, but not, you know, really in the same milieu. But yeah, it's just, I mean, I guess maybe it's just a symptom of, like, streaming TV's hunger for shows based on the recent past, but it's interesting to see the same faces and the same personas crop up over and over and, you know, kind of shows that in this, like, very rarefied world of people slinging around millions of dollars is, you know, kind of small in that these people all knew each other.
Yeah, and when Adam Newman says, you know, because they're like, we're bleeding money, he's like, you know, Google, Apple, Uber, they all bled money too. You know, they all lost money at first. Amazon, Twitter, I believe, wasn't Amazon like not profitable until like very recently?
I would believe it.
Yeah, which is just sort of insane to think
about.
But
it just shows the capriciousness and the like kind of insanity of these business models, which is that there is none, that it's just based around massive growth at like by any means necessary as fast as possible. And like pumping up, like creating an inflated value so that you can then IPO and pay out your investors. And like, actually, the product doesn't seem to matter that much.
No, I guess that's true. I mean, I think Elizabeth has more of a sort of messianic vision for herself and this idea than do Travis or, I mean, I don't know. Adam Newman, I've sort of mentioned a theory on this podcast before that, like, I think We Crashed feels more about this era, this kind of ethos, than about a particular company, you know. And I think that we really see that coming in with Rebecca's wellness talk, which is really kind of just borrowed from her cousin, kind of, and Goop. I mean, we literally have a reference to the infamous Jade, what is it, yoni egg?
The look on that actress's face as she's walking away with the egg. Really did.
Oh, I wonder
me.
How many takes that took, or if she just nailed it on the first, because it's really good. And I don't know, I guess in the way that America Ferrera plays Alicia, you kind of wonder why she's wooed by all of this.
Well, especially because she's represented as a person who's actually, you know, self-made, actually made a tangible product that people can use in a way that I don't know. I mean, Uber, sure, but in a way that I don't think Adam or Elizabeth actually does.
Right, exactly. And obviously, like, Rebecca sees something to envy in that, and also maybe to get close to, just to, I don't know, by proxy kind of osmose some of that self-made confidence and success. And I guess Adam kind of sees it too, and he's looking sort of more vampiric in this episode, and he just is like, well, here's someone who's actually
that's Morbius you're seeing.
Oh, it's a Morbius promo, of course. Right, yeah, I forgot that it's that they're in the same cinematic universe, right? Oh, well, I mean, Adam Newman is Morbius, I guess. But you know what I mean? Like,
that's what's going to happen in the back half of season one.
They've kept that really under wraps, but
it'll be a big surprise.
Gabe Sherman didn't spoil that. Yeah, I don't know. I did a little Google for Alicia Kennedy's name just to see, you know, if she was a real person. But, you know, it's a fictionalized name, at least. And there was one description that was like, America Ferrera will play a character on the WeWork show who takes a job at WeWork and then it destroys her life. And I'm just like, I feel really bad. And I wish I could just be like, no, go wander away in your mummy costume and don't, you know, don't spend any time with the Na'vi.
But yeah, I guess it's valuable to see how even somebody cynical and inexperienced and, you know, somebody who has a mind for business could get drawn into the cult of WeWork. Like, it seems the Newmans are powerful and charismatic and have the ability to, you know, ensnare people that would think maybe that they would be able to resist.
Yeah, and I think that, like, one thing that's so strong about the early episodes of We Crashed is that while you know that he's a huckster to some extent, the way that Jared Little plays Adam and the way that he's written, there is something magnetic about him, and I would say charming even, because he's just an oddball, but he's one who is, you know, he's not aggressive like Travis Kalanick. He's not a shifty liar in the same way that Elizabeth Holmes is. He's gregarious. He has a warmth about him. You know, he was raised on a kibbutz. Like, there's something kind of earthy in a way about him. But I think this episode really tries that affection. You know, I found him, and I think it's on purpose, really exhausting in this episode, and the way that he's just throwing stupid Wagyu beef parties and then having Run-DMC while people are packing up their desks, you know.
Yeah, there's a let them eat cake aesthetic happening.
Well, it brings to mind, what was it? Was it BuzzFeed, the Happy Spring email? Happy Spring, we're laying people off.
Oh God, I forgot about that. I blocked that.
I mean, like, that's the thing, is like, it's stranger than fiction, you know, like, this stuff really does happen, and it's kind of horrifying. Speaking of kind of people entering in companies and then it not being quite what they hoped, at least. I mean, I don't know how Huffington felt about this, but I was Googling David Bonderman, who is the other new board member in this episode of Super Pumped. And he apparently, during a board meeting, Huffington said something like, you know, studies have shown that if there's one woman on a board, there will soon be two. And then Bonderman said something to the effect of, actually, what they say is that there's just going to be more talking.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he, even though he's the one who brings Huffington in, is one of the sort of avatars of this, you know, boys club mentality at the company. So you kind of, I don't know, watching these three episodes, you kind of feel like, I don't know, are women doomed in these spaces inherently? I don't know. I don't really know how to.
Well, you do get a sense that sort of like Elizabeth Ariana has kind of learned to use femininity to her advantage. I mean, she makes men omelets. She wins them over by making food for them.
Yeah, what does he say? This girl makes a mean Greek omelet. It's like, it's really grim. Should we get into at all about the Google of it all on Super Pumped? I mean, was it funny to see David Krumholtz pop up for you? Because I was like, oh, there he is, you know, Santa Claus.
Yeah, both him and Ben Feldman. I feel like these shows are all kind of made for you being like, oh, I know him. Like, everybody who pops up is recognizable in some way. Like, I forget the character's name on The Dropout, but the lab supervisor who then speaks to John Carreyrou, that's the guy from Wet Hot American Summer who does the magic show.
That is an actor named Kevin Sussman.
Yes.
And
it's so nice to see him popping up.
It is. When I was in college, so this was the 1960s, a good friend of mine who lived in the dorm room next to me, he had been in something, maybe it was Wet Hot American Summer, that she really liked, and she decided, and she did this for years, that she was going to, like, follow Kevin Sussman's career. And so she'd, like, check his IMDb every once in a while, she'd watch whatever he was in, even if it was, like, a bit part. And so, yeah, there was a nice little nostalgic thing to see him, just as it was on The Dropout to hear Kesha.
The Dropout's music, the needle drops continue to just really hit you right in the chest.
Including Tyler Schultz, as played by Dylan Minnette, singing The General by Dispatch.
That was
a song I have not thought of for many years.
I could feel like the Birkenstocks on my feet again as he started.
I looked down and I was wearing a puka shell necklace. I don't know how that happened.
I was at a campfire somehow.
I was trying weed for the first time.
We had just come from PacSun.
Right. Exactly. I just made another necklace at Beadworks. Okay, this is a dumb question, and I think it's probably unfair to the real life people, Tyler and Erica. But is there a little romance-y vibe in this episode between them?
It feels, or am I just like imagining things? I don't know if the show intended there to be, but it does kind of feel, if it were not based on real events, I would expect them to be getting together at the end. I know that Tyler is married to somebody else. I'm not sure what Erica's status is now.
Yeah, I don't either, but I do know that Tyler and Erica still work together.
They started
some kind of initiative recently that's like about tech ethics, I think. So if nothing else, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship and work partnership. And I think that's maybe I'm mistaking for romance, which is just like, oh, here are two relatively more principled, relatively more decent kids who are, yes, going to take down this bad situation, but also like are finding themselves in the process, you know, as corny as that might sound.
Yeah. And she's also interesting as a representative of like the working class, which I feel like kind of nobody else on either of these shows really comes from. Like she is somebody who does have things to lose, who can't throw caution to the wind, who has to actually worry about her own bottom line in a way that certainly none of the founders do. And it's an interesting tension for the show to introduce.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, that her one ally has to be the kid who's like, oh, my grandfather ended the Cold War and is on the board. And she's like, well, he seems nice enough and like, this is the best I've got. So,
yeah, no, of course, other people didn't speak out because they were afraid that they would be blacklisted and never work again. And, you know, it has to be somebody who has a safety net.
Yeah. And Sonny makes those threats manifest. I mean, he really does literally just say that, you know. I also think that the funny kind of odd couple pairing of Phyllis and Richard Fuse is really well done in this episode. I think, you know, when I talked to Liz Merriweather, she was like, the first few episodes are more comedic and then it gets darker and darker, which has borne out. But I liked a little bit of the squabbling comic relief of these two, you know, more seasoned people in this world just really bickering at each other and yelling on the phone. What did she say about... He was like, I'm trying to set the scene. And Phyllis says, he's a writer. He don't need to do that when they're on the conference call with Carrie Yu.
Yes, the enemy of my enemy.
Yeah, I really hope we get more of them. It seems like we will.
Do you hope that we hear another song that Tyler wrote?
Oh, Hillary, I have to be honest. I fast forward. I couldn't do it.
So difficult to, I mean, you know, not because the performance is bad, but just because it's so humiliating. This song compares Elizabeth to Galileo, Tesla, the biblical Noah. Like it is, you know, you talk about messianic, like it was right there. Like it is basically calling her a god. It is so nuts that she inspired this at all, like let alone in people who should have known better.
And I think that what that is, and which just makes the exploitation even like grimmer, is that it wasn't a rideshare service, you know, it wasn't a sort of woo work share space thing. It was like, we're gonna save people's lives.
Yeah.
And so it's that much easier to, I think, dig in on the cult, to the extent that at this person's 30th birthday, very young still, they're wearing masks of her face, which I believe did actually happen.
That is so creepy.
And it's like supposed to be like
she enters and it's really eyes wide shutty with everybody like turning around for her only to see her own face looking back at her.
And behind one of those masks in theory was Henry Kissinger. Watching that performance was, you know, noted
layers
war criminal
of horror.
Henry Kissinger. Yeah. It's pretty bleak, and I have arrived, I think, at the point in the dropout where I'm really eager to see the fall. You know, like that sympathy has been worn down to some extent, and this culture has gotten gross enough that actually, kind of for all three of the founders on these series, like I'm reaching a point where it's like, okay, now let's get the Schadenfreude, not even the Schadenfreude, the sort of justice of it. I'm ready for that.
Do you feel like the balance is right, that there is less emphasis on that aspect than on the buildup?
I think that, you know, for audiences who aren't going to read the supplemental articles or read the, you know, listen to the, you know, fact-based podcasts, like, I think it is important to have a strong sense of how things began, because a lot of people like myself have absorbed the news of the downfall, but I didn't really know how it got to that point. Mm-hmm. So I think in that way, the shaping is correct. But, you know, these are three different shows in some ways, and the stakes are higher and lower depending on the series. So whereas I really like the human approach to We Crashed, and I think that's necessary, I think that part the Uber story does need to be a little bit more techie in the weeds, and also didn't start. It's not an origin story, that show, Super Pumped. You know, right. It starts in medias res, and I think that also was necessary. So it's just an interesting thing to see these all these different writers coming to these projects and telling the stories in different ways, and based on, you know, a book in one case, a podcast in another podcast, I think in a We Crashed case. But yeah, I think that like the arcs seem to be reaching their peak, and we're now going to be in some denouement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should also, this is sort of apropos of nothing, but I do want to just let everybody know that in Brooklyn, there does exist a lactation consultant matching service called Boober. Travis should perhaps not be raked over the coals for coming up with that, because somebody took it and ran with it.
It's a real thing. Well, with that, Hillary, I think we've reached the end. Unless you had anything else you wanted to bring up.
About lactation.
Yeah.
I think probably we can leave it there. I'm sure that one of these people would love to disrupt that industry.
Well, it's there to be disrupted. Well, Hillary, thanks for being with us. Once again, if you have any questions, concerns, comments, corrections, all that, please email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Hillary, where can people find you when you're not talking about Boober?
You can find me on Twitter at Hillabuster.
And you can find me at Rylaws. This episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez. And until next week, happy investing.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors, as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
From PRX.